Tower, WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Welcome to this week's edition of the Sunday Spin for November the 5th, 2017. Yes, the first Sunday in November. Welcome once again to our weekly look at politics from City Hall to Springfield and off to D.C. So it's time to grab that Sunday paper, go get that cup of coffee. We'll do our best to get your week off to a good start. We're rolling right into November. And by the way, it is 7:09 a.m. Want to remind you about that with the clocks. That extra hour of sleep felt pretty good this morning, Dave.
Yes, it did. Always look forward to setting my clocks back on Saturday, actually, because of the fact that we get up so early in the morning to come here into work on Sunday morning. The clocks are set back late in the afternoon. So as far as I was concerned, when it was 6 o'clock yesterday evening, it was 5 o'clock.
Oh, so you were all kind of progressing into that kind
of
mindset.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
And even despite the fog, it is, you know, still kind of bright outside, which is nice.
Well, that's what happens, you know, when you set your clocks back. Get ready, though. It will be dark probably around 5.
Did you set the car clock, too, or did you have a heart attack?
No, you know what?
That's
the last one. It's funny you should say that, Sam, because that's the last clock I haven't set. So when I got into the car this morning, it was 4:30. But I knew better. I knew better. I knew that this was not the Twilight Zone.
But how long does it take you to change the time on the car clock?
A couple of seconds.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
It's not one of those.
No, not a big deal.
You have to look up the monitor and all that.
No, not at all. I just turn the little knob, and it turns the hands back on the clock.
The hands? And then you get on your rotary phone.
Yeah, I was driving a 1962 Chevelle.
He puts in a quarter.
Oh, wow. Well, at least it was, you know, it was easy to get up this morning, where yesterday, with the rain and the drizzle.
That rain was intense yesterday morning.
And it was a great sleep-in day until the Thunder Boomers came in.
Whoa. Right.
Man, and I swear, one had to hit right by us, you know. And the reason I think I know that is because I think it fried my Wi-Fi router.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Can't get it to work. And I even had a surge protector on it. And it's dead.
Hmm.
So it was, I'm Wi-Fi-less.
Does that mean you're entirely without internet then at home? Or?
No. The internet, but it's the old-fashioned way where you have to plug it into your computer.
Oh, okay.
With the cord.
Yeah. You don't have a dial-up modem, do you?
That's what I thought when you said old-fashioned.
Well, that's old-fashioned now, is being connected by cord, right? Isn't that, Sam, everything?
You've got Ethernet is what you have.
Yes, I have the Ethernet connection. But is everything in your generation has cut the cord, right?
We had dial-up, yeah, when I was a kid.
You remember dial-up?
Oh, yeah.
With all the squeaks and noises and all of that to get connected to?
Of course. Do you remember dial phones?
No.
That was pretty emphatic. No.
Oh, dial-up was great.
Dial phones and party lines.
Wow. Okay, Andy. Wow, one crank on the phone, and you get to the operator, and you're all set, right?
And you have different ring rhythms, 3 shorts and a long. That's when you should pick up.
That's code for something.
That's code for something. The bell would ring, 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 ring.
Really? That.
That was 100 years ago. That's the way it worked, and you listened for that pattern.
Really?
I'm serious, yes. I'm not making this up.
What part of the world was this in?
The United States of America, my friend.
I loved, you know, with the old dial-up modem, and I was an early AOL adopter.
Yeah, me too.
So you would, connect to the internet, and then AOL would spend the next 40 minutes with the blue bar going across as it updated.
Yeah. Uh-oh.
Nightmares. There it is.
I'm amazed that they still have them.
I bet in some places they do.
Yeah.
Now, I had this great little, actually one of the first portable computers was from Radio Shack, the famed Trash 80.
Is this pre-laptop Trash 80?
Yes, pre-laptop. It was the first laptop, actually.
Mm-hmm. Was it an actual laptop?
Size? No. It didn't have like a flip screen or flip up. No, it was all like a tablet sized, notebook sized with a keyboard, a standard keyboard. And then it had four lines of type that you could read in a black and white kind of thing that you could type your stories on.
Yeah.
And then to send them in, you had these clunky rubber couplers. And so you would dial into the modem there and stick the phone into the couplers.
Right. Yeah, I remember those couplers.
And pray.
Pray that it would connect.
Connect. And that these couplers didn't get mangled, in your bag, which would happen. You'd have to replace them like every 3 months.
Or that there would be garble on the other end.
Well, that's it if you got a staticky phone line, too.
Yeah.
And although maybe that was some of the best work I ever did was, with the static helping to edit the story. always seem to get static for my stories, but especially with the
static of a variety.
Static of a different kind. But so I'm going to be shopping for a router and I'm figuring out what to do to make, because Alexa's got nobody to talk to.
Well, she doesn't talk to me, so.
Well, I mean, she's all by herself now in the cloud somewhere because, and I feel sorry for her, so I'll have to get her back.
When you get back up, you're gonna have a message from her saying, "Thank you for restoring me. I wondered where I was. I couldn't find you. I missed you."
Just take a router from work. No one will care. Ask Ferg.
Well, Hey, I know the equipment around this place. I'm sorry. I'll be shopping on Amazon for that. I would ask Alexa to do it, but of course I can't talk
to
Alexa.
You can't talk to her.
So, no. But anyway, well, Blackhawks playing well. Back-to-back shutouts for Crow. That's fantastic.
Yeah, he stopped his last 59 shots, 35 on Wednesday and then 24 last night. And, when you don't let any in, it's hard to lose.
And I know... Did they announce who's starting goalie tonight?
I imagine they're going to give the backup a crack, Forsberg.
I know, but Q was talking about, because Corey plays very well against Montreal, and Q was tempted to leave him. But I don't know. Coming off back-to-back shutouts, he might be a little gassed there. But that'll 6 o'clock tonight, and you can catch all the action here on WGN. Looking forward to that. It was also nice when the Blackhawks beat the Wild. And fortunately, Aunt Jo in Minnesota, I think she was more preoccupied by watching the Gophers playing than she was with the Wild. So I didn't get any nasty text from her last night when the game ended. But great game. Some great football yesterday, too. Great college football games.
Northwestern winning in overtime.
Third overtime in a row.
That's a record in the FBS in college football. In the higher rankings, that's a record. No team had ever won 3 overtime games in a row.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Got Dave Ennett really excited. We'll hear from Dave Ennett in a little bit. The Cardiac Cats!
The Cardiac Cats.
Dave's going to go into a cardiac arrhythmia. That team's going to kill him one day.
But he's a diehard purple. There's no doubt about
Absolutely.
That. And Iowa with the big, big win over Ohio State.
55-24.
And so I'm trying to figure out, like, Who's left in the Big Ten that could, get into the championship?
Wisconsin. That'd be it.
Yeah. I mean, because...
They're 9-0. But they need some help from above. Well, they got help because Penn State lost.
Right.
Ohio State lost. They're going to need a lot of help. They're going to need a loss by Notre Dame, probably by Clemson, and then TCU. So there's a group of teams ahead of Wisconsin, But they're the only team from the Big Ten that has a chance.
Yeah, because it just seemed like that was yesterday was knocking themselves out of each other for getting up there. So
did you see the Oklahoma State final?
I did not. I wanted to see that.
62-52.
Oh, man.
62-52.
Whoa. So the defense just didn't show up on either side.
They slept in. They didn't change the clocks.
Well, and it's given us Oklahoma, who knows what year those clocks are in, too, you know, but okay, sorry.
Just like in my 62 Chevelle.
Exactly. Well, it's foggy here in downtown, but we'll try to cut through a lot of that fog on our Sunday spin. Dave's here to keep us up on all the news. Sam has the latest sports. Producer Cassara is here to field your phone calls. And we're at 312-981-7200. Our text line, 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin, all one word. We're on Twitter @SundaySpin, and Engineer Bob's trying to stay awake despite the time change. Remember, you can find all of our programs on WGNRadio.com. You can also get our podcast at iTunes by searching for Rick Pearson. Central Standard Time. Hope you all got the clocks changed and reset the timer on the coffee to get the coffee this morning. Good morning for a good warm cup of coffee. Well, now it's time for our weekly spin through national politics. A lot of controversy going on over the excerpts coming out from a new book by Donna Brazile, the former Democratic National Committee interim chairman. And a lot of controversy going on because a lot of the things that she is writing in these excerpts are being disputed throughout the Democratic Party, particularly among the Clinton administration. Washington Post has an excerpt that with Hillary Clinton as the party's presidential nominee, that she seriously contemplated trying to set in motion a process to replace Clinton with Vice President Biden, with then Vice President Biden, because she called Clinton's campaign anemic and that it had taken on the odor of failure. So this is kind of interesting because there's actually, yeah, there's a process that would take place, but there isn't a process that could necessarily be instigated by the Democratic National Chairman. And this is just among several parts of things that she's written that cause controversy. She wrote that the was the issue of the primary nomination fixed? And she said, well, she was shocked when she found out that the Clinton campaign basically, in her words, had the say over all of the spending of money that was being raised by the Democratic Party during the primaries when she was, of course, being challenged by Bernie Sanders. Now, apparently, upon looking at the actual agreement that existed between the Clinton campaign and the DNC, that say was about the general election campaign, not the primary campaign, and that the Sanders campaign also had similar rights to be able to share in the fundraising, shared fundraising with the DNC, but they exercised not to do so. So there's a lot of controversy about this book and a lot of people complaining that this is Donna Brazile trying to stir up sales for her book. And, of course, you know, she became somewhat discredited when it was revealed that she had provided debate questions for a CNN debate to Hillary Clinton. So there'll be more fallout, there's no doubt, from what's going on with that book. So that's on the DNC, the Democratic side. And then, of course, you know, last week we started out the week with the indictments, the special counsel Robert Mueller overseeing the grand jury indictments of former Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort, Manafort's business partner, Rick Gates. But perhaps the most interesting part of all of this was the news of the guilty plea by George Papadopoulos a former foreign policy advisor to the campaign. Papadopoulos pleaded guilty to lying to federal investigators about meetings in March and April of 2016 with a Russian agent who promised dirt on the Clinton campaign. There are more details about meetings now with Trump campaign aides and Russians. And the Mueller probe has sparked concern about whether Mueller is safe in his job. A Republican Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, he told Fox Business News he doesn't understand where that talk is coming from.
The president hasn't talked about it. And remember, in the last 3 months, his lawyers have been trying to cooperate very definitely with the special counsel. And I don't know why this would even come up as an issue unless the president talked about it. If the president wants my advice, I would say just let the special counsel do its job.
Now, the White House has sought to describe Papadopoulos as a low-level staffer, even though he was seen in campaign meetings with Trump and discussed engaging Russia help with Attorney General Jeff Sessions. So, all in all, these indictments seem to be really a beginning rather than an end. But meanwhile, CNN's Brian Stelter last week, he had an interesting look about how the president, who's now in Tokyo for talks there, but how the president has been using Fox News to get his talking points. And CNN put together a mixtape to kind of prove the point.
You could make an argument for Thomas Jefferson and George Washington. Are you going to change the name of the Washington Monument?
Are you going to slave owners?
Yeah, absolutely. That's my point.
I wonder, is it George Washington next week, and is it Thomas Jefferson the week after? You know, you really do have to ask yourself, where does it stop?
Judge, I have an idea. Let's build the wall and let the dreamers stay.
We're looking at allowing people to stay here. But very importantly, what we want, we have to have a wall.
If you thought the cover-up by Nixon of Watergate, just a covering up a third-rate burglary, was a big deal, this is covering up Russian taking over control illegally of U.S. uranium assets.
I think the uranium sale to Russia and the way it was done, so underhanded, with tremendous amounts of money being passed, I actually think that's Watergate modern age.
So that's CNN doing the Fox version and then the Trump version. Very kind of interesting. And, of course, anybody who follows the president on Twitter knows the correlation between something that he sees on Fox and Friends in the morning and those morning tweets that he sends out.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I want to thank the texters out there who are helping me with my modem problems, although it's really a router problem, but I think I have it under control. And I also want to thank someone who actually found a photo of the old trash 80 acoustical couplers, those things that used to break down. So Sam, I'd encourage you to take a look at this, the picture on the text line.
Oh, I see it.
Yeah. that's how the world used to work.
That looks like something I would pour booze into in college.
I'm sure that's probably happened, and not that, they were rubber. So they didn't, I guess they would hold a shot. I don't know. Given that you're sticking phone, you were sticking phone receivers into them, I'm not sure that I would be using it for shots.
What is that called?
That's the acoustic couplers that you would plug the phone handset into.
Mm-hmm. Whatever you said.
And that's how you would send your story.
I have no idea what that is.
What do you mean?
I've never seen it before.
Well, it's a type of modem.
Right, right.
It's a type of computer modem. That's all. If I can, I'll find. I think I still have my trash 80 somewhere. I'd be happy to show you how we used to do things.
Cool.
Okay. Before the one click days. Okay. My way of helping out. Well, welcome back to the Sunday Spin. In that last cut that I played, you heard the president talking about Hillary Clinton and this, quote, uranium deal kind of thing. And I thought it was very interesting because a lot of turning tables after the indictments, Trump and other Republicans saying the Justice Department should investigate this uranium deal that occurred under the Obama administration, and it's tied to Hillary Clinton and the Clinton Foundation. Well, the other morning, MSNBC host Joy Reid, in her program, she questioned a former Republican spokeswoman about the deal.
Who got the money when the Canadian company was sold to the Russian company, Uranium One? Who received the money?
I presume the company, but look.
Yeah, okay, second question. Mm-hmm. Who approved the sale? Because when any sort of uranium or any company that sells sort of sensitive type products, and by the way, the uranium that's mined in these mines, right, is for nuclear power. It's not for nuclear bombs, right? But when that happens, there is an organization called CFIUS that approves it. Do you know what CFIUS stands for?
Yes, absolutely.
What does it stand for?
Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States.
How many people sit on that committee?
9 members.
How many have to approve a deal like this?
All 9 of them,
members.
I believe.
How many
approved
this deal?
9 of them.
Did Hillary Clinton sit personally on that deal?
No, but she
did
pushed
not.
For it.
She, no, she
and
did
you know
not.
What?
No,
hold
on.
Here.
Who is the person who donated to Hillary Clinton who is related to and had an investment in Uranium One? What is that person's name? Do you remember their name?
They are board members of Uranium One, donated up to $143 million.
Tom Huestra. And when did
to
Tom
the Clinton
Huestra,
Foundation.
Did he own any assets in Uranium One at the time that Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State?
You know, I don't know that,
did
but
not.
Here's what I would
sold them.
Here's what
years
I'd like
before.
To know.
So hold on one
you
second.
Should, you
no,
just want
he
to know
sold
too.
Them years before.
Yeah.
So what you're talking about is a deal that 9 members of CFIUS approved unanimously, none of whom was Hillary Clinton. You have a donor who separately gave Hillary Clinton donations at a time when she was not Secretary of State. The two things cross in the night. They have no relation to each other.
So there's kind of you know, a little bit of more context to something, and you know, certainly it's being talked about, but it's questionable about what connections really existed all over that. Well, joining me now on the program, I have the two men who were a major part of trying to redevelop the old Nichols Library in downtown Naperville. Jeff Brown and Dwight Avram are here in the Allstate Showcase studio. And I just find this to be a very interesting story because, and having lived in Naperville and knowing it very well, and the vibrancy of the downtown is unparalleled, I think, as far as older communities and just the vibrancy and feel that you get in downtown Naperville. And you guys are working on a project. And I actually, Dwight, why don't you go ahead and just, if you would, give us some of the history here of what exactly has resulted in this project now being at a standstill.
Well, we started with the Truth Lutheran Church, who had acquired the property from the city about 20, 25 years ago. And Truth Lutheran Church has lived in the building, and the building has basically gotten old. It's a small group of people, so they're not able to necessarily maintain the structure the way they'd like to, so they needed to move on. We were brought in to help them find a relocation, and that started back in like 2013, 2014.
I was going to say, this has been going on, I mean, this has been an evolving process.
Yes. We went with city staff to find out what locations in the community would be acceptable for relocation of the church. And we discussed what we could do with this particular property at 110 South Washington Street in downtown Naperville. The city staff told us there was only one issue with the property, which was a covenant when the city had sold the property back in, I believe it was 94, 95. And that covenant only dealt with the facade of the building from the front, which is a perpendicular approach to Washington Street to the building, so you're looking only at the front of the building. And it dealt with the interior vestibule, which both of which are probably remarkably close to the original, although the vestibule has been changed from what it was when it was constructed back in the 1890s. So,
yeah, and we're talking about, I mean, there is some historic significance to this property. I mean, 1898, I think, was when it was was built in the city's first library, and architect M.E. Bell was the architect of this. But then Naperville obviously grew, and they grew into the new Nichols Library that's along right by the river.
Right.
And modern state-of-the-art library. And so it was an idea to kind of find some property for the congregation.
Right.
And then what do we do with the old library?
Well, that was part of the issue. A church had been approached several times by people that just wanted to buy the property. And unfortunately, it's a membership of someplace between 80 and 90. They just didn't have the capital coming in to be able to relocate. Because obviously they don't want to disband their church. They want to find a new home for it. And so we tried to help them figure that out. And in the process, we made a deal with them that we would take their property on Washington Street and provide them with a new home. That new home will eventually be on the corner of Mill and Bauer, which we're under construction with right now. I would think that, in the process of dealing with the city staff, going through the issues of the facade and the maintenance of the facade and living up to the covenant that was put on the property when the property was transferred from the church or to the church from the city, we were just trying to go through the issues. And we came up with something like maybe 12 potential variations looking for comment. We've had public meetings. We've asked people to come in and talk to us about it. We've met with different groups and organizations, city council staff members. We've met with city council members. We've met with people from the historic preservation groups, which there are a variety of them in town.
Well, and Jeff, what concepts were you looking at for this kind of property?
Sure. So from the onset, the intent was to abide by these covenants that have been in place since the mid-90s when the city sold the property. We were excited about the notion of the church being able to continue going forward, building them a new site. Like Dwight said, this property at Millenbauer is all of, maybe it's 2 miles away, so they're staying in Naperville. Now they're afforded a parking lot. They're afforded a new building that doesn't have the mold and the flooding issues and the asbestos and whatnot that the current building contains. And so, our intent was to go forward, abide by the covenants. We had, like Dwight said, through city staff's input, played with in keeping with the facade. Do we keep it in its current place within the site, which is roughly 25,000 square feet? Do we move it to a more prominent location within our building that we had proposed to build, all the while maintaining it but just moving it? So there were different variations that we had played with, all of which, though, entailed keeping that facade and keeping the vestibule in place.
.49 on this Sunday morning, Central Standard Time. I'm sorry to do that. I'm sure you've all taken care of those few clocks that don't change themselves, but I just want to remind you. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio with Jeff Brown and Dwight Avram, and we're talking about what happened to their plan to redevelop the old Nichols Library in Naperville. And so you guys get involved in this project. You are building a new church for the congregation that had been in there and go to the expense of building a new church for them. You guys now are looking at the various plans for what to do with the old Nichols Library, go to all of the council zoning, all of those kinds of things, city manager looking at all these designs. And then you get to the city council and what happens? As they point fingers at each other.
Well, we went through the process over about a four-year period of time to develop a concept for that site and to move the church. And in the exercise of going through with staff, we finally got to the point where the staff was willing to approve and recommend to the Planning Commission our concept. And so we filed, I believe it was the end of May, first part of June.
That's about right.
With the city, for our petition to do redevelopment of the 110 South Washington property. Shortly after that, this group came out of the middle of nowhere and filed a petition to landmark the property, which wasn't ever in any of the discussions over almost a four-year period of time with the city and the city staff. So it's just like, we have a covenant that we have to live up to.
Well, I was going to say, there is the covenant was kind of the ground rules that you were operating
under. Absolutely. And then the landmarking group came in and filed a petition for landmarking, which totally changed the game plan on private property, which has never been done in the city of Naperville before. It's possible it's been done other places, but in Naperville it has never happened, and it's truly counterintuitive when you want to do a development to a property.
So the council votes 6-3 to landmark the property.
Right.
And that leaves you with what?
Leaves us with a property that's partially undevelopable.
And where do you go from here?
As we continue to point to each other.
Yeah, or is there anywhere to go from here?
So that's
I did see, you know, I saw there was the one concept before the vote where even to move the building.
Right. There have been several approaches from different groups of people. The Naperville Settlement, we've had discussions with them about moving the building over there. We've had discussions with a random group of other people who have made overtures, if you will, that they would take the building to another location in the city. There seems to be a group of people that are interested in moving the old Nichols Library, now a church, to the new Nichols Library, which is over in, you know, Jefferson Junction area, that thing. And there's some interest. You know, we've seen talked to some city council people that have an interest in that. We've talked to some people that seem to have an interest of seeing it move to the Naperville Settlement. We have a plan that basically tears down the 1962 edition and the 1939 edition, and with landmarking, we have a 29 by 50 building that is now landmarked that we have to work around. We can either incorporate it in our new design in the building that we're going to build, or we can sell it to somebody else, or we can gift it to an organization like the Naperville Settlement, which really is probably where it should eventually go.
Well, and it would kind of fit into what the
Naperville Settlement is all about.
Right.
It's a tremendous, tremendous project to start with.
Right.
But
with the landmarking, does that affect moving the building? I mean, is it, you know?
We're going to find out. So the $64,000 question right now is, what are you going to do now that landmark status has been filed? And so, you know, big picture, we're not here to complain. We're not here to, you know, cry about what's happened in the past. We're here to try to be solutions oriented and figure it out. We went before city council saying that, you know, Dwight and I both are common sense folks. We're not trying to be adversarial. We're not trying to do anything that would harm the city, the preservationists, whomever. We're here to work within the city groups and select individuals that might take exception with the fact that this is a historic building and it needs to be preserved. So we're trying to incorporate as many concepts that have been put forward as possible and ultimately lead to an economically viable development for us. That was the intent in the first place.
And I was going to say, I mean, certainly the covenant would seem to recognize the historic purpose there, and that it's you know, an attempt to try to find the fine line, the medium line between historic preservation as well as, you know, economic development in one of the state's largest cities.
We said this at the city council meeting, you know, with the landmark status being imposed and being imposed as quickly as it was, there was just limited, if any, dialogue between the parties leading up to the 6-3 vote against us on the landmark status. But our, you know, Our perception at the time, and maybe it was a bit raw, was that, you know, we knew what we were buying when we bought the property with the covenants in place, deed restrictions and whatnot. To put the landmark status on it after we had bought it and against our wishes felt like, you know, the proverbial goalposts were being moved, and I said, if not even taken off the field entirely. You know, in hindsight, knowing what we know now, it's questionable at best to think that we would have ever bought the property in the first place.
Or would anybody?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, because, and again, you know, you're engaging in ostensibly good faith negotiations with the city throughout this entire process,
Absolutely.
A four-year process, and all of a sudden, in one vote, it's done.
It's done.
Right.
So, well, and part of the reason I wanted to have you guys on was I also noted, and I understand we're talking, this is private property that gets slapped with this after the fact.
Yeah, the city owned the property for almost 100 years before they sold it to a church. It's never been subject to real estate taxes because when the city sold it, they sold it to a church.
Right.
There was ample opportunity for the city to recognize the historic significance in this building if they wanted to save it. they closed the building 10 years prior to their actual sale of the property. So it just seems like, you know, dealing with a covenant which was part of the sale that the city made with the church, that was up front. We all understood that. This is coming in way after the fact, after we spent literally years trying to work with city staff and other people that had an interest in the covenant to try and find a positive solution for the community and then redevelop the Washington Street property. This is just, it's a taking, if you will, of private property.
And as I've mentioned, that's what I think is what is so concerning here. But even in, and I saw the story just the other day in Champaign, Illinois, where the Champaign School Board, they've got three buildings that they want to tear down to expand their central high school. And another body, the city government, the Historic Preservation Commission slaps landmark status on that. So you have even a government fighting a government,
right,
in this case, over, you know, expansion and development kind of issues. So
it sets a dangerous precedent. That's one of the things I think, you know, as Dwight and I talk more about this publicly, again, we're not here to rehash history, but we are here to say it creates a chilling effect on certainly local real estate values. It's almost a buyer beware sort of notification where, let's just keep it to Naperville for a minute. As private developers enter Naperville to contemplate going forward with development or repositioning properties, whatever the case is, the fact that a new precedent has been set whereby the city can come in and landmark your property post-acquisition against your desires is a warning shot. And so that's...
Well, can you still redevelop this property through the Historic Preservation Commission, or is that just not a viable alternative?
I think the bottom line is we can. The reality is, you know, we've got to work through, you know, a few more committees. The same folks that were very vocal about preservation and landmarking are the very folks we're going to need to go back in front of in order to get a development approved. I just want to be careful with what I say, but you know, several comments were made at city council meeting about our proposed development that had nothing to do with the landmark status, commenting on the size of the building, how tall it was, et cetera. That wasn't the point of the city council meeting. The point was either landmark or non-landmark. So we have a sneak peek, if you will, as to what their perception is about our proposed development under as-of-right zoning, where we don't need a zoning variance or anything to proceed with the development. But we do need to work through appeasing the landmark crowd, and that's if we go that route, that's what we hope to do. But just rationally speaking, commonsensically, we're the very people that you know shut us down in pretty short order are the people we're going to have to go back in front of.
Thank you, gentlemen, Jeff Brown and Dwight Avram, and we'll be following what goes on, because I have a feeling this story isn't over right now.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome to the second hour of your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower on North Michigan Avenue. A foggy Michigan Avenue, but the temperatures are holding pretty decent. And I'd say enjoy it now, because obviously we've got rain in the forecast, because we haven't had enough rain lately around here. The New York Times and CNN, they've had exclusives on a new book by author Mark Updegrove. It's called The Last Republicans, and it deals with the relationship between Presidents George H.W. Bush and son George W. Bush. And Updegrove did an interview with CNN that the elder Bush didn't really have a great description of President Donald Trump.
He's a blowhard. He's a blowhard. I don't like him, plain and simple. And I'm not excited about him being a leader, was his quote. And if you look at the Bush family, it makes perfect sense. Donald Trump is everything that the Bush family is not. George Bush grew up thinking about the greater good. Donald Trump, I think, is manifestly narcissistic. Mm. It's part of his brand. And that brand is the antithesis of the Bush brand.
Well, the White House fired back at those remarks, and from White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders in a statement to the Hill newspaper. Quote, the American people voted to elect an outsider who is capable of implementing real, positive, and needed change instead of a lifelong politician beholden to special interests. If they were interested in continuing decades of costly mistakes, another establishment politician more concerned with putting politics over people would have won, unquote. That's White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders in response to the comments of both Presidents Bush in the new book, The Last Republicans. Well, joining me now on the phone is Sarah Feigenholz, Democratic State Representative from Chicago. And I wanted to have Represent Feigenholz on the show because not only do we have the General Assembly coming back into session this week for the final week of their veto session, but we also find lawmakers convening in an aura of controversy over the issue of sexual harassment allegations, and something that has not only kind of inflamed Springfield, inflamed politics nationally, but worldwide. I saw a tweet this morning of front pages across Great Britain of similar allegations and controversies going on in the British Parliament. So, Sarah, thank you so much for joining me.
It's a delight to be on the show with you, Rick.
Well, I want to know now, late yesterday afternoon, the Legislative Ethics Commission announced that a former U.S. attorney, Julie Porter, had been appointed as a new legislative inspector general. And she was a member of the prosecution team in the Conrad Black trial. She worked on public corruption cases involving not only former governor and prison governor Rod Blagojevich, but Bill Cellini. And, you know, as much as the issue of sexual harassment has come to the fore, has also been this issue of the General Assembly's failure to move forward in with the legislative inspector general's post.
Well, I think that you're going to see a flurry of activity this week about closing a lot of these loopholes. We've read a lot about some of the vacancy, the Homer vacancy, and the way the construct. But even more important than that is the path to filing a complaint and the comfort in which somebody finds in that process. You'll see lobbyists will be brought into the fold, and the beginning of a, you know, we don't have a human resource department.
I was just going to say that is the line. There is no HR department to go to.
That's right. And so we don't have an opportunity. It's kind of a 17th century work ethic, you know. I have this vision of a woman being dragged across the Capitol Rotunda by her hair, you know. It is kind of there does need to be a lot more checks and balances in this system from the top down. And we are beginning to see a lot of conversation from young women about situations that have been put upon them that are revolting. It unearths a lot of memories for women, as you saw last weekend when you saw some senior members of the U.S. Senate and Congress talking about their experiences as interns and new attorney and young attorneys, budding attorneys, the kind of harassment that they put up with, the kind of inequities that they were faced with. And I think that the Weinstein factor has really ignited just a brush fire of people coming out, women mostly telling their stories about what happened. And it's got to stop. It just has to stop. I spent a great deal of time with a lot of these young women trying to open a door for them and show them how things work in Springfield and talk about public policy. And to see them walk out the door after putting one or two lines on their resume under the dome to say, I'm out of here, I can't handle this, is heartbreaking. And we've got to stop it. We want more women in public service, not less.
Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, joined on the phone by Sarah Feigenholz, Democratic State Representative from Chicago. And we're talking about the issue of how sexual harassment has come to the fore in regards to, you know, not just politics. I mean, certainly the Weinstein situation in Hollywood. But is it a matter of the fact that, like in other areas of life where, you know, the legislature, you know, in its day was almost exclusively male, and now you have, you know, the empowerment of women into various sectors of life that were exclusively male dominated?
Well, this is a very male dominated profession, and I think you make a great point that I think that where there's no HR department and there is a male dominated profession, That is a really bad combination. Would you agree?
Well, I mean, there are no rights.
Right. Well, there's, you know, it is a fertile ground for problems, and this is where I believe harassment of all kinds, not just sexual harassment, but competition in the workplace is fierce. There are still a lot of men out there, Rick, who do not want to see women succeed and don't like them. Or, you know, are able to act badly, and women don't get promoted. We need more women in leadership in Springfield. We need more legislators. One of the great losses from my perspective was my dear friend and a frequent guest on your show, Representative Elaine Nekritz, leaving because of the toxic environment. Barbara Flynn Curry, the majority leader, stepping down at the end of this term, leaves, you know, a lot of open discussion for where are we headed. And with half of this world made up of women and about 25% of legislatures around the country, women representing a much smaller percentage of 50%, it's time that we really evaluate. How, you know, men can talk about sexual harassment when they're victims, but speaking for women all the time when they're not the victims is sometimes a little hard to swallow, if you know what I'm talking about. So I really think we need my mother used to say something, don't ever ask the doctor, always ask the patient. We have to figure out what women need to succeed. It will be our legacy, and I know it will be mine. I want to see women thrive in a government environment, in a political environment to change public policy. And, you know, you and I have talked about a lot of women's issues over the years. One, of course, was House Bill 40, the ups and downs of that. And honestly, these are issues women need to talk about and need to be the voice of. And the silver lining here, of course, is that we're now having serious and open discussions about sexual harassment, women in leadership, and hopefully we are going to fix this problem and stay focused on changing the behavior. We can write as many laws as we want in Springfield, as you know we do. But if we don't change the culture and we don't stop pointing fingers at each other and using these things as a partisan issue and stay focused on empowering women, I mean, that's what I'm hoping we will accomplish here.
Well, Representative, you actually got to the point of my next question, because we already saw one lawmaker saying, you know, well, you know, the idea of the mandated training or whatever, well, training, you know, whatever, blah, blah, that, you know, if that's just for show, you know, it doesn't mean anything. And, I mean, as you said, it's about a correcting a culture. And that's something you can't legislate.
That is correct. And, you know, hopefully what we're going to do, you know, we're scheduled to have a task force that is going to continue to work on discrimination, not just sexual. And I believe that there is a commitment to continue this conversation and do a comprehensive review of some of the social consequences of this discrimination and how the women of the state have been suffering from it. So, you know, when it comes to issues of, you know, daycare, child care, and women being able to achieve economic independence so that they can, you know, we have a lot of women raising children alone in this state, and we have a lot of women representing them in the legislature, and we need to get their voices heard. And if they are bothered along the way by bad behavior, they need to be protected by laws that include anti-retaliation and whistleblower laws, and they need to be able to report this, Rick. Part of the problem is that women do not complain because they feel like where they file their complaint, there is a conflict. So we need to really look carefully about creating a safe path to report this kind of sexual harassment. And I think you even heard Tom Homer, the former IG, talking about how, because of lack of transparency, this was a toothless tiger. And I think that that's alarming. So we have a lot to look at after Julie Porter does her cursory 27 cases.
Well, do you think just having this conversation and this issue might lead to maybe a more greater understanding of overall women's issues in the legislative forum?
Well, I mean, ultimately, that is the hope. I do think that the lid blew off the Capitol in the last 2 weeks. I'm sure you would agree with
yes.
that.
Yes, indeed.
And that I think that a lot of people have been saying, well, nothing is going to happen if women don't name names. And, you know, my attitude is if they want to name names, those are their stories, and they are entitled to that. Some of them don't feel safe because they don't have any protection. There's no anti-retaliation clauses in Illinois statute to protect them. But one thing I do know is that everyone's on notice, that women are ready to do whatever it takes to change the culture in Springfield now.
Very quickly, second week of veto session. Obviously, this is going to be a dominant subject down there. But we also have, you know, some of these legislative overrides that the House is considering, including one that failed previously about the issue of local right to work zones and banning those in state law. Is that, in your view, coming back for another vote, and is it going to be successful?
You know, I think that there is a conversation going on. That one, of course, very important to the working men and women of this state, and I'm hoping that we can override that. I don't know the answer. I think that there may be some bipartisan discussions going on.
That's Democratic State Representative Sarah Feigenholtz, Democratic Representative from Chicago. Thank you so much for joining me this morning.
It's always a pleasure.
Now, the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson. A couple of personal notes. Just a reminder that today, from 1 to 6 o'clock, is the Scrabble for Literacy Challenge by my friends at the Literacy Volunteers of Illinois. And that's up at the Grossinger Honda, 6600 Northwestern Avenue. Registration from 1 to 2. It's always a literacy challenge. You know, even as a reporter, literacy can often be a challenge for me. And there's no bigger challenge than trying to play Scrabble against some of these folks. But it's a lot of fun, a lot of prizes, auction prizes. And you can get more information at lvillinois.org. LVIllinois.org, and I'd encourage you to help my friends out there. Also on Wednesday, this Wednesday, November 8th. I'll be out at Aurora University for their Town Square series, and I'll be speaking with former U.S. Transportation Secretary, former Central Illinois Congressman Ray LaHood, and we'll be talking about Secretary LaHood's tenure and also his book, Seeking Bipartisanship, My Life in Politics. And I've known Ray for many years, and he has some very interesting things to say, and actually almost kind of gives a historical perspective of how our politics and our civic life has really just turned in such a nasty way, and about whether there's any hope to kind of return some civility to civics. And so that's out at Aurora University at Premi Auditorium at 7:30 on Wednesday night. And you can get more information at aurora.edu. So we look forward to seeing you out there. Big week in last week in Washington. The GOP tax proposal comes out, but it's far from a done deal. We've got the president wanting to insert provisions to remove the individual health care mandate, so you're tying health care into tax reform. The plan would remove the medical deduction that helps the elderly. It would take away deductibility of student loan debt. We already have talked many times about state and local tax deduction would cap property tax deductions at $10,000. It would not allow deduction of state income taxes, would change mortgage deductibility. The Republicans want to move forward. They want to move quickly and get it to the president by Christmas. And a Trump-supportive super PAC is airing ads featuring former Trump strategist Corey Lewandowski.
This is an urgent message to fellow patriots and friends. Americans need to get behind President Trump's plan to get our economy moving again. His tax plan cuts middle-class tax rates, lowers rates for job creators and small businesses, and eliminates special interest loopholes. Friends, the special interests will do anything to stop us. We can't let them. Call your congressman. Go to our website. Stand with President Trump to cut taxes now. Help make America great again.
So that's former Trump strategist Corey Lewandowski appealing to the patriots. And joining me now here in the studio, the Allstate Showcase Studios, Mike Meany. He's the executive vice president of the Chicagoland Apartment Association. Mike, as always, thanks for joining me this morning.
Great to be here. Thank you, Rick.
Do you agree this thing is far from a done deal? Or do you think the rush to act is kind of overtaking things?
I think that from what I'm hearing is that it sounds like there is momentum, and it would not surprise me if the House met their goal of passing this out of the House before or by Thanksgiving. I think it once it goes to the Senate, of course, things may slow down a bit, but I believe that the Republicans and the president think that they have a real opportunity to finally achieve meaningful tax reform, something that has been talked about for a long time. So it wouldn't surprise me if it moves pretty quickly.
Well, but it's like everything else, and when you see people holding a postcard and this is all you're going to need to file your taxes, the devil's in the details.
Correct.
And there's still big questions here about how those details can affect individuals, and you already are hearing the Democratic drumbeat that, well, this is just tax reform at the expense of the middle class to help the wealthy.
Right, right. Yeah, I think that, it certainly will, tax reform affects everybody. And, you know, when they talk about loopholes, your loophole is my tax relief. So, you've heard the saying, don't tax you, don't tax me, tax that fellow behind the tree. So, everyone wants to protect their interests. And so there will be furious lobbying going on, I'm sure, over the next several weeks. Groups like mine, the National Apartment Association and others will be making their case that, we need sound tax policy to make sure that we keep investment going and that, it ends up good for the economy in general.
Well, and certainly, as a component of the economy is real estate, development, you know, those things going forward. I mean, we know that the home builders and the realtors are already, they're no on this at all. I don't know what the National Apartment Association is, where they are on this.
Well, we are, again, we're looking into the details. You know, this thing was just released and really kind of in just talking points last week. So, you know, we'll be looking.
And there's a difference between talking points and what's actually in the legislation.
Exactly, right. So the policy experts at our national association will be looking into the details. But, you know,
I know you guys do have some concerns about certain items that I don't even know if they're in or out.
We do, yes. And you know, at first blush, we're pretty optimistic and happy with what's been proposed, because we were concerned that there would be, you know, there might be an effort to eliminate some programs that are very beneficial to and promote the development of apartment buildings, not only market rate buildings, but low income housing in particular. So, for example, the low income housing tax credit,
right,
is a very important tax policy. 90% of affordable housing in the country is built using that program. So, you know, we were pleased to see that the that this proposal does not eliminate the low-income housing tax credit. However, the value of the tax credit is diminished a bit because of the lowering of the corporate rate from 35% to 20%. So many investors would take advantage of the low-income housing tax credit so that they could get a lower rate and not pay the 35%. So lowering it to 20 does diminish the value a little bit.
And in turn might turn into less interest in,
exactly,
development.
Exactly. Right. So, you know, but we could hopefully work through those issues. Another policy that we did not touch was the 1031 like-kind exchanges, which is where investors can, if you want to sell an apartment building, for example, you could defer payment of the taxes on that until a later date. And this has been shown to facilitate transactions, and when you have real estate transactions happening in the economy, it's good. There's money flowing, and that's a good thing. So, you know, for the most part, like I said, we're still looking at the details, but for the apartment industry, we're pretty optimistic.
Do you think by perhaps limiting some of the homeowner deductions that might, how does that translate into the apartment industry?
Well, I am, you know, there's going to be a lot of discussion about that. As you said, you know, there's some very powerful interests that are going to be, you know, I'm sure talking about that issue. But, if the incentives for home ownership are not viewed as valuable as they once were, then perhaps people may take a second look at renting. But, you know, we have seen, even without tax reform and you know, any changes in the mortgage interest deduction or deductibility of state and local taxes, we have seen renters and renting as an option that people are choosing, as opposed to, you know, being forced into
it.
Exactly. And, you know, with the mortgage interest deduction, I read something in the Tribune this morning that I didn't realize. Only 7.6% of mortgages taken out in Cook County are over $500,000, and that's what this new proposal would do. It would lower the amount of the limit from $1 million, I believe, to $500,000, on which you,
right,
could deduct interest. So yes, there's, you know, look, there's still obviously a lot of people to take advantage of that, but and again, it's not eliminating completely. It's for people that have current mortgages, they can still deduct,
right,
as high as they want, right? This would be for new mortgage loans, and also only above the $500,000 threshold.
Welcome back. back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, joined here in the Allstate Showcase studio by Mike Meany, Executive Vice President of the Chicagoland Apartment Association. Got an interesting text because I was talking about the devils in the details on the tax reform proposal that the Republicans are pointing out. Rick, where was your need for details when the ACA, Affordable Care Act, was being presented? We've only been on the air since 2014, and that was signed in 2010, so I'm really sorry. If I'd had a show, we would have certainly talked about the details of the Affordable Care Act as well. So thanks so much for your text. Well, so, Mike, I want to switch gears from the tax issue to another issue that everybody is talking about, Amazon HQ2. And, you know, you're part of this group of the horde of 600 people that are have been tasked with, you know, helping in presentation and trying to improve Chicago's chances of getting it. I, being the skeptic, think it's like winning the lottery, and that's just me anyway. But certainly, you know, the economic benefits that would accrue to the city and the state would be tremendous.
Yes, I agree. And I don't, you know, dispute your observation of it being, you know, I have seen studies or reports that show Chicago in the top five.
Or the bottom five.
Or the bottom five, right. Exactly. So it's very...
And they both say they're using Amazon's criteria to make those judgments.
Right. So it's a little, you know, I really don't have, I wish I had a, you know, crystal ball. But it is exciting. It's obviously something that the city needs to pursue, and it would be a huge a get, so to speak, I think, for, you know, not only the mayor, but for Chicago. 50,000 jobs over a 10 to 15 year period is pretty impressive. And from my perspective and my association's interest, those people are going to need some place to live, and many of them will choose to live in rental housing. So we're very excited about the opportunity. You know, certainly if it happens, it's going to be a challenge. But I think we provided some information and some research to the city to include in their presentation, which shows that Chicago is, as much as we, you know, some people might think that it's not affordable, but when you compare it to the coasts, to New York and Philadelphia and San Francisco and Seattle, rents here are very affordable in comparison. So, and we also have room to build.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. Are we sufficient now, or is it with what's still to come?
Yes. Well, obviously, if, you know, 50,000 jobs here, either downtown or, you know, someplace in the city or even, you know, in the suburbs, there's going to be a need for additional housing. And I think we do have the downtown market is it's tough to find land here now, and it's very expensive. But there are opportunities in the neighborhoods. We were talking earlier, and we have seen, emerging demand and attractiveness to the West Loop, to, the Milwaukee Avenue corridor.
What's it called?
We talked about the Hipster Highway.
The Hipster Highway, yes.
A lot of desire there. And the South Loop where you live. So, you know, we see the boundaries of, you know, where people kind of wanted to live expanding. And there is a lot of apartment developed in the suburbs as well. People would be surprised. So I think we have there's a great opportunity there. And, again, it would be very exciting, and we certainly would welcome the challenge should we be chosen to be the new HQ2 city.
I know, you mentioned the West Loop, and it's, the construction going on out there is unbelievable. And, you know, everybody thinks of the West Loop as, well, Sam Toya, my friend from the Restaurant Association, and it's all about the food and all that. There's the housing that's going up out there is unbelievable.
Right. Well, people want to live near those trendy, great restaurants.
So they don't have to cook every day.
Exactly.
They can just walk out their door, and there's another restaurant that's just moved in.
Right. Yeah, the city has done a great job of creating new desirable neighborhoods and you know, places where people want to be. You know, when I was younger and first moved to the city, everybody wanted to live up on the north side, you know, in Wrigleyville, and still that's obviously a very desirable place, but there just seem to be so many more options these days and really great places to live.
You touched on the fact about property downtown is now, you know, gotten very expensive. But how does that play into apartment development?
Land is a huge cost of developing apartments. So, you know, probably up to 25% of the cost of development. And we've had some challenges with that, and you know, part of it goes to policies that the city has been implementing, and you know, in an effort to develop more affordable housing, which we certainly understand and support. The city has you may have heard of the Affordable Requirements Ordinance. It's
right.
Basically an inclusionary zoning policy, and what some of my members have told me, developers, is that because of the cost of land, it's very difficult to make those investments work.
Because it's an offset kind of
exactly.
thing.
So basically you're required to provide and set aside a number of affordable units in an apartment building. And it could be a luxury building where the rents are very, very high. The land is, the cost is very high, so you have to build that into the cost of the project. And when you have investors who are looking from outside of Chicago, and they are, you know, they're looking at the costs, and they're seeing that the numbers just don't work. You know, building apartments is a business, and people do, investors do want to make a return on it. And so, you know, we have seen national companies, you know, look and say, well, you know, that just doesn't work for me, so I'm gonna invest in another city and not Chicago. Now, you know, we have been, you know, we've had 3,000 additional units built in the downtown area this year. We're looking at probably another 3,000 next year, and then in 2019 I think they're estimating 4,000 units. So, you know, you can't you look at that and you can't say, well, it's stopping development, but it is becoming more and more challenging.
Mike Meany, Executive Vice President of the Chicagoland Apartment Association, as always, thank you so much for joining me this
morning. Thank you, Rick. It's a pleasure.